The name Huxley has for nearly a century been synonymous with literary brilliance. Ever since Thomas Henry Huxley took up the verbal cudgels in defense of Darwin's evolutionary theories, the English reading public has expected and found first-rate artistry and profound thought in any work printed under the name Huxley. Aldous Huxley, the grandson of Thomas Henry, added considerable luster to the family name in the 1920s with his trenchant satires on English intellectual life. Antique and point-counterpoint are already classics. And very few literate people are unfamiliar with Brave New World, Mr. Huxley's frightening picture of the world of tomorrow. Since the late 1930s, Mr. Huxley has lived in Los Angeles, occasionally writing scenarios for the movies, but concentrating most of his effort on the study of the mystical religions and on the exploration of the psychological mysteries of the human being. On a windy March afternoon, a team of interviewers drove up a narrow, twisting road in the Hollywood Hills to the home of Aldous Huxley. This team was to interview Mr. Huxley on the general subject, "Can physical affliction lead one to creative endeavor?" Few living men are as qualified as Mr. Huxley to speak on this subject. For not only is he a consummate literary artist, he has been, as you will hear him describe, for the greater part of his life, afflicted with partial blindness. Mr. Huxley himself met the members of the interviewing team at his front door and led them into his light and airy living room, in which not only the ceiling, but the floor and the furniture coverings were white. Now in his 63rd year, Mr. Huxley is a self-described extreme ectomorph, tall, thin, and reminding one of a coiled spring. After the recording apparatus had been set up, Mr. Huxley eased himself into a chair and graciously invited any and all questions. The background noises which you will hear were supplied by a gusty, kite-flying March wind. Well, Mr. Huxley, you've written that the most important single event in your life was the onset of eye trouble. Perhaps we could start here and fill in some biographical detail around this event.
Well, it happened when I was about 16 and a half, and I got this violent attack of keratitis, which left one eye about 9/10 blind and affected the other quite badly. At last, I was unable to do any reading for nearly 2 years. I had to leave school and had to have private tutors, and I learned to read Braille, and even Braille music, which is very difficult. And then I was able, after about 2 years, to read with a rather powerful magnifying glass, and then I went through the university on that basis, and it gradually got a bit better and stabilized, and I've been able to keep going more or less ever since then. But it was of enormous importance to me in this sense that automatically such a thing cuts you off from a great many activities. I mean, it automatically cut off all types of sport. It cut off a great many ordinary kind of outlets for social communication with people of my own age. And it did undoubtedly stimulate a tendency, which I think I have by temperament, to a tendency towards solitude and what may be called contemplation. So that in a sense it confirmed things, and then it, well, I mean, of course, among other things, it was, fortunately for me, it prevented me from going to the First World War, in which the majority of my friends were killed. And so I have no doubt may owe my life to it. And I would say the few things have been more important to me. It was a decisive turning in one direction. It meant that there was no question of what I could do. I had intended, while I was at school, to become a doctor, but I couldn't use the microscope, and therefore had to change my whole career, and I took to writing instead. So that in that sense also it was a very important event in my life.
Had you thought about writing before you had the eye trouble?
Well, I'd always, like most adolescents, I'd written bad verses. And actually, while I had the eye trouble, I learned to typewrite, and I even wrote an entire novel when I was, which I never read, because I couldn't read what I'd written. So.
Well, you wrote in The Art of Saying what a great deal of difficulty you had in the actual physical processes of reading, how it was difficult to read words and phrases and tiring and so forth. Well, it has amazed me that you've been able to amass such an amount of erudition with this handicap.
Well, looking back, I'm always amazed at the amount of reading I did with a small and powerful magnifying glass. It must have been very bad for me, but I succeeded in getting through it. And then, as I think I said in The Art of Seeing, I did have to go on stepping up the magnification of my glasses, and I'd reached a point where I was rapidly losing vision and not at all not knowing what I was going to do next, and then very fortunately came upon this system of re-education, visual re-education, which has helped me a great deal and keeps me on an even keel so that I can keep going.
How did you happen to hear of Dr. Bates' technique?
I heard of it from, first of all, by somebody I was staying with in North Carolina who had been benefited by Bates, and then I happened just by chance to see the name of a man here who was practicing it, who unfortunately was no good. Then I heard of somebody else who was a little better, and then I heard finally of somebody who was very good. And I've been extremely grateful to it, but it's, as I say, it's permitted me to use what vision I have to the best of advantage.
Yeah. Well, in a great many of your works, you exhibit a enormous amount of knowledge about art and sculpture and architecture. When did your interest grow in these?
Well, I've always had it. I mean, since I was an undergraduate, I think at that time I made the acquaintance of a number of painters and art critics and so on, and it influenced my thinking and seeing a great deal.
What I was really curious about was how it was possible for you to really see these things sufficiently in order to appreciate them.
Well, maybe I never did see them sufficiently well. I saw them as well as I could, which was as much as can be asked.
Medical technology today is preserving in a less than perfect state many people who in previous times would simply have died. What do you think can possibly be done to help these people, that is, especially the young people?
Well, a lot is surely being done in the way of educating people with special handicaps, and I think that more can be done than is being done. And I would say, too, I mean, quite apart from the handicapped, a great deal can be done to teach everybody to make use of their resources. It seems to me quite clear that most of us live at about 15% of capacity, and that with suitable education, psychophysical education, we might live at 25% of capacity, which would be a very good thing. But this is something which is totally neglected in our schools at present.
Do you have any suggestions as to how this education could be improved?
I have written a little thing about it. I mean, this volume of essays which came out last fall, the Tomorrow, 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 the first essay and the second essay called The Education of an Amphibian, and Knowledge and Understanding are two sort of sketches of what
I think, could be done in that field. I think a lot has been found out empirically, and a great deal of work is being done, so to speak, on the periphery of a circle, and at the center is a basic biological principle, which is the principle of perfect functioning, which is the paradoxical one that in some way or another you have to combine relaxation with activity. You have to be active, and yet at the same time you must do it without strain. And this, every teacher of psychophysical skill has always found this as an empirical fact. The golf professional, the tennis professional, the piano teacher, the singing teacher, they all tell you exactly the same thing. And this goes, I think, right through life. I mean, this is surely the secret of the extraordinary grace of animals, that they somehow combine activity and relaxation, and it's also the secret of the extraordinary ungracefulness of human beings, most often, that they somehow strain while they're being active. They try to do things out of the top of their head by the surface wheel, instead of letting things happen, sort of getting the surface wheel into harmony with the rest of the organism, and so permitting the life force, or whatever you like to call it, to flow through them freely. And I would say there are certainly perfectly good methods of educating people in getting out of their own life, which is the final problem. And this can certainly be applied in special cases with people with handicaps, and it has to be applied still more so that they can functionally use what little is left of them on an organic level. Poor organic equipment, but if your functioning is good, then you can to a considerable extent overcompensate for this.
Would you think this or these new methods of education can possibly be incorporated into our public education, or will it be merely a private matter?
Well, what is perfectly clear at present is that extremely few people are trained in this. I feel very strongly that what is needed now is for some a foundation or other to set up an institution where this thing can be experimentally tested. You can bring together people of different disciplines, psychologists, medical men, physiologists, sociologists, bring them all together and see, and then to examine all the work which has been discovered empirically by specialists in various fields, see how it can be coordinated, see what light it throws on this basic principle, and then see how it can be applied in public education. I think this is a 10 or 15 year program, but I think at the end of it we should have something which would enormously enhance the general value and efficiency of education on every level, from the kindergarten upwards.
Is there any possibility that such a foundation will be formed?
I don't know. I've talked to people, various people on various foundations, so far without any success. Some people have listened sympathetically, but I think sooner or later this will be done. For example, John Dewey, who after all is the apostle of modern education, stressed this very strongly in a number of his writings, but this aspect of his teaching has been completely neglected, largely because nobody is in a position to teach the teachers, or much less the teachers teaching the pupils. So here again is where some foundation with money and with an ability to bring people together in one place is tremendously important.
What would the program be?
I see several programs. The program would be, for example, what sort of postural position is the best for good functioning? We do know something about this. Is there any way in which we can control the wanderings of our autonomic nervous system? Many people are thus the victims of their autonomic nervous system. And some small degree of control of the nervous system, or the autonomic nervous system, is obviously of great advantage. I mean, you know, we don't have to go as far as the Hatha yogins who can do these extraordinary stunts, but this takes many years to acquire. But it's very easy for most children, for example, to acquire sufficient auto-hypnosis to shut off pain when they get it. Well, I don't see why they shouldn't be taught this. I mean, I know a number of dentists who use it all the time with their child patients and even with their adult patients. I think there are a number of other areas in which these sort of techniques can be taught.
What do you feel the implications of this would be for society as a whole?
Well, I think we should probably behave a good deal better. I mean, after all, the great, most conspicuous fact in the moral life of man is that he's always making good resolutions and hardly ever keeping them. But this might provide us with a method of actually carrying out our good resolutions. I mean, we know that just by an act of the will up here, it's very difficult to carry it out, but we also know that if you can somehow get the deeper mind to accept this good resolution, it will carry it out. And this is the whole secret of suggestion. And if your suggestion, of course, can be used frightfully badly, I mean, look at the appetizers, look at the brainwashing, look at all this, but at the same time, like all powerful tools, it can be used well. And that probably if you learn to use it well, you're less likely to be betrayed into using it badly by other people's machinations.
Mr. Huxley, you've written a good deal about the problem of personal psychological freedom and the problem of political freedom. Now, in a world in which the political problems are so extremely urgent and so extremely critical, how is it possible for a person actually to take the necessary time out, as it were, to work on this personal psychological freedom?
Well, of course, it's perfectly true. I mean, you have to have both, quite clearly. It's no good. I mean, the life of the ideal Stoic living as a slave like Epictetus, this is very noble, but it's certainly a very undesirable form of society. I mean, it's much better if people are living as free men and are also living like Epictetus. But after all, people find time for an awful lot of funny things in this world. They find time for looking at TV for 28 hours a week. And if they took 2 hours off to do something else, they might learn a great deal.
Do you think that there's any possibility that people will be brought to this point of view other than as a result of a global catastrophe?
Well, yes. I mean, a lot of curious things are happening now. I mean, in a queer way and not very well directed, this sort of preoccupation is very widespread. I mean, look at all these positive thinking, new thought movements now. I mean, as long as I remember, 45 years ago when William James, 50 years ago when William James wrote The Varieties of Religious Experience, he said he thought that the new thought movement, which was sort of coming into its own already then, would probably turn out to be the great American contribution to religion in the 20th century. Well, he may be quite right. I mean, this is a real preoccupation, and I think the thing has many good merits to it, but I think it also is too much preoccupied with using God for the purpose of making money. But it can be used for many very useful purposes, and I think there is. I mean, the fact that hundreds of thousands or millions of people are concerned with this, I mean, they may not have got hold of the best possible tool, but they're certainly using some tool, and it's an effective tool in many ways. And I think it's the fact that there is this interest shows that this could be a little better directed than it's being directed now, and that I think James is quite right. This probably does represent a new departure in Western religion. I mean, which is essentially the idea that, in theological terms, that God is immanent as well as transcendent, and that you can get at God in his immanence more easily than you can get at him in his transcendence.
You say you believe this movement could be a bit better directed than just being directed now. Would you care to comment further on that?
Well, what I was saying, I mean, I think it is a little too utilitarian in some ways. I mean, I think all this is fair due, and it may be is the opening wedge which will bring a lot of people in. And I think, again, this has a very valuable side on the health side of it. I mean, this is ties in with all the modern medical preoccupation with psychosomatic medicine. And this, again, is a way of getting at the autonomic nervous system and getting your organism to behave better than it will behave normally under the sorts of stresses of modern life.
Mr. Huxley, if we may now turn more specifically to our general question, that is how affliction may inspire one to greater creative effort. We know that in an animal, an automatic physical adjustment often occurs when one of its senses is impaired, which makes another sense more acute or perceptive, and thus compensating for the loss of the first. Now, do you believe a person makes a psychical adjustment when he becomes afflicted, so that he uses a greater part of his intellectual or creative potential in an effort to compensate?
I think this often happens. I mean, it's quite clear that blind people listen more acutely and attentively than other people. I mean, it seems awfully difficult to generalize in these cases. I mean, some people obviously don't permit themselves to go down under an affliction, and some people bounce up and find ways around and are stimulated. I think this, I mean, for example, I know the cases of the blind. One of the great problems in dealing with people who suddenly become totally blind is to get them to accept the whole situation. They have to accept that they are, in a certain sense, dead to one life and are starting a new life. I mean, they have to accept a kind of death. And then, on the basis of this other type of life, then they can, once they accept this, then they can undertake the education suitable for the blind with greater enthusiasm and greater chance of success. And I think this is probably terribly important in the case of handicapped people, of their being told what to do. I mean, I think some people discover it for themselves, but a great many do require guidance and help in those cases. Did you ever read a book by a friend of mine, Betsy Barton, called... The Long Walk? She herself was paralyzed in the legs, and she gives a very moving novel about people paralyzed during the war and their education, their re-education, and the appalling problems which they face, and how many of them, if they're not helped by people with a real understanding, does go under. So that I would say yes, on condition. I mean, it's a conditional thing. I don't say that it happens automatically.
Do you think the nature of the affliction has anything to do with whether a person keeps going down or bounces back up?
I think it does. I mean, blind people appear to be on the whole less melancholy than deaf people. I mean, completely deaf people, in a curious way, are apt to feel more cut off almost than the blind. And this is a very grave thing. I mean, when people feel themselves really totally isolated from their fellows.
A person who's lost his sight is normally inwardly looking, since he can no longer look outward naturally. Is this introspection likely to give him a truer personal perspective and thereby greater recognition of or concentration
concentration on any latent creative talent.
I wonder, I mean, I suppose one would just have to study a lot of cases to answer. I don't know what the general answer would be there. I was trying to think what cases one can think of. I mean, Milton, of course, went blind when he was quite advanced in life, so he knew all about exactly what he wanted to do by then. Prescott, the historian, went blind. I mean, he wrote the whole of his History of Mexico when he was blind, didn't he?
How about you in your own personal case?
Well, I mean, as I say, this, for example, leaving school and being on my own and learning from tutors and being a great deal by myself, I mean, I think certainly that this did make me develop certain resources. I mean, for example, this fact that I was saying that I wrote a novel. I mean, I couldn't see. Well, I certainly would never have done this if I had been in my right mind. I mean, being at school and doing the ordinary things. But this certainly pushed my mind in that direction.
In the case of Milton, do you think that his blindness affected the later affect, I should say, the quality of the work that he produced after he became blind?
Didn't seem to at all. For the whole of Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained were written when he was blind.
Well, what I was getting at was not a diminution in quality, but whether he actually became more sublime because of the blindness. Is it possible?
I wonder, because such an extraordinarily disagreeable man, anyhow, but whether he was more disagreeable or less disagreeable as a result of going blind, I don't know. I always feel so extremely sorry for Milton's daughters, who had a really bad time, and his wives. I don't know. I mean, there are, of course, magnificent passages about his blindness. I mean, the sonnet and the passage in Paradise Lost. He was, of course, I appeal always with him that everything was always under complete control with Milton. I mean, he had the most sort of conscious mind of any of the poets, I would say.
In the perennial philosophy, you say that no one need be the victim of his peculiar talent, that all of us have the power to use them well or badly. Do you believe there's a transition in an afflicted person which causes him to use his talents more creatively? That is an afflicted person more likely to use his talents well than badly?
Again, I don't think you can generalize. I mean, I think some afflicted people are... Well, I mean, take the case of Byron. I mean, it's clear that his club foot was of great importance in spurring him on, I think, to make this extraordinary achievement, I mean, to be both an aristocrat and a poet. And he was spurred on in a great many curious directions at once. I mean, he was spurred on to behave pretty badly with women, and he was spurred on to do this enormous labor of writing these endless poems. I mean, this is the extraordinary thing. This man always pretended to do no work. Obviously worked about 16 hours a day on writing these things. This seems to me, well, this is a sort of question which I think one could only answer by a study of the individual cases. I mean, take the case of Keats, for example. I mean, what did that do? I mean, Keats, to start with, was very nearly a dwarf. He was exactly 5 feet high. And he developed TB when he was 19, was it, or 20? Well, I don't know. I mean, TB, of course, does, in a way, even a sort of premonition of TB, certainly seems to enhance the energy. I mean, there seems to be a sort of terrific output of energy, as though the organism realized that the time was short and that an
enormous lot had to be crowded into a short period.
If an affliction spurs one to creative heights, would you say it is better for him not to recover his impaired sense if in so doing he loses that creative incentive?
Well, I wonder whether he would lose it. Yeah, I suppose he might. I don't know. I mean, it might be in the delight of being able to look at TV, one would never be able to do anything else. I don't know. If one had recovered from blindness, though I rather doubt it. I think it would, on the whole, it would go on. I mean, I think that once people had discovered the pleasure of creation, as after all it is, in spite of it being very laborious, a very great satisfaction, I don't think they would let it go so easily.
Well, perhaps what I'm asking is more of a value judgment, Mr. Huxley. Do you feel personally that a person would be better off with all his physical health and perhaps do nothing creative than to have some physical impairment and be a creative writer or musician, etc.?
Ah, well, now this is, depends who, from whose standpoint you're asking. I mean, from the point of view of the world, it's obviously much better that he should be a tubercular, whatever it is, and create. But maybe from his own point of view, this is a very difficult question. I mean, he might prefer very much to be a sort of ordinary, healthy young man or young woman wandering about and behaving just as the average behaves.
Would it be fair to ask you which you would prefer?
Well, I would certainly prefer. I happen to like writing very much, and I imagine that actually I would have, even if I hadn't had this eye trouble, I would always have written. I mean, I feel quite sure if I'd been a doctor, I should be a pretty bad doctor and got out of it pretty quickly if I could have managed to have gone into the field of writing, probably, or anyhow into the field of research and then maybe into the field of writing.
Commented earlier to you that perhaps we're moving away from the printed word with the advent of television, records, radio, and so forth, movies. I was wondering perhaps if we might be entering what could be called an age of scripts, in which words were written down only so that they could be acted or spoken or reproduced in some way or another.
Well, I'm all for this. I'm all for the revival of spoken literature. I mean, this was, after all, the earliest form of literature, and it was a sort of subsidiary form right up into the 17th century. I mean, if you read Aubrey's Brief Lives, I mean, you will find he's writing after the Civil War in England and looking back at his childhood and saying what an extraordinary difference this has made. I mean, that it was a great revolutionary break in traditional life. And he makes the remark there that in his boyhood, practically every country gentleman in England had his private harper, a man who played the harp and who sang ballads, and this was the and invented things too. I mean, this was a regular form of spoken literature which went right on into early modern times. And I think it's immensely important to develop these things. I mean, there's a great economic problem involved here too. I mean, we're up against this problem that with the rising costs, what may be called straight publishing is becoming more and more difficult. You can't break even, publisher can't break even on a book on a sale of less than about 6,000 or 7,000, which means he's very reluctant to take on any either new book or experimental
book on popular subjects, and this is really a form of censorship. We have political censorship in these totalitarian countries, and we have economic censorship here. Well, if you can, and then you have this effect that a great many people somehow hesitate to read. I mean, a lot of people are convinced that somehow the classics are too difficult for them. And if we can get the recorded literature sufficiently cheap, I think it may serve to bypass this really very serious problem of economic censorship. I mean, I can envisage the time, and if you can have records which play not at 33 but 16 or even 8, which is perfectly possible for a spoken record, you can get so much onto one disc that it then can compete with the printed word. And I think you could even, for example, I can envisage the time when young poets may publish on a very, very slow playing record and be able to sell it, be able to produce it on their own, but quite a small amount. I mean, the actual capital outlay is very small on these things, and sell it as cheaply or cheaper than they would in book form. And this would be all for the good. And I think you would, if... I mean, there are certain types of literature which are quite obvious should be spoken. I mean, all poetry should be spoken. And what may be called the literature of wisdom should be spoken. And they're already there. You have a great outlet for the spoken word. And I think that if publishers would really work on this problem, they could find a large new audience extremely receptive to very good literature, who at present, because of the cost of books and because of the sort of phobia which so many people seem to grow up with in regard to books with hard covers, this would bypass this, and they would read things or listen to things that others said, which they wouldn't dream of contacting otherwise. So that I'm all for this. I think it's a very important, and we're now technically beginning to get very close to it. I heard, for example, the other day that the Library of the Blind, you know, this thing that Congress sponsors, the government-sponsored thing, it's done by the Library of Congress. It's not very good so far. They haven't got a very good selection, but they're now having a model phonograph built, extremely portable, which can play at 16 and finally 8 revolutions a minute, which will permit enormous amount, I mean, about 2 or 3 hours a side on these things, so that you'll be able to get whole books and a couple of records. But I mean, once this has been produced by the Library of the Blind, then quite clearly it will go over into the commercial field. And I notice already all the new phonographs are equipped with 16 revolutions a minute speeds. They're all on 4 speeds now. And there is, of course, a certain amount of spoken literature already on this 16 a minute. So that I think that within the next 10 years we may see a very important revolution in this field.
Do you think that the spoken record would be enough in itself, say for poetry, for example, when you quite often read a poem or hear a poem and you want to go back and look at it more carefully? Would you have to also have the published word along with it?
Well, I can envisage a lot of things being published in 2 editions. I don't know. I mean, I talked to a number of publishers about it. I mean, I tell them that I feel quite sure that if they make the experiment, they'll find that they don't kill their printed edition. They merely add
a new public. I think this will happen. I mean, I don't know. But my feeling is that this would happen.
Ed Murrow's book, This I Believe, you wrote that one of the duties of man was to get his ego out of the way so that the divine force of his, divine source, pardon me, of his life and consciousness could shine through him. Now, what effect do you think literature can have in bringing about this de-eclipse?
Well, I think it can always, as it always has been, it can be an enormous spur and stimulus to people. Literature's obviously been able to affect people in all manner of ways. And I think it can affect them in this way just as in any other, I think. You can exaggerate the force both of bad literature and of good literature. I mean, bad literature is very effective.
Well, you yourself have had an enormous circulation and a tremendous volume of books, and now in the last year and a half or so have been publishing monthly in the Esquire magazine, which has a very large circulation. But do you have any idea at all what effect you have had on the readers? Or is there any possible way of ascertaining this?
There isn't really. I mean, I get a number of letters, but I mean, these, of course, are obviously extremely few in relation to the total circulation. So one doesn't know. But, and of course, here again, one is up against a very strange and often rather disquieting fact that I think all writers and lecturers must have discovered this, that the difficulty of communicating with people. I mean, it's been the experience of most lecturers that I've ever talked to, that they will give a lecture and then people will come up after the lecture and shake them warmly by the hand and say, "Oh, Mr. So-and-so, I'm so glad you said this because I agree entirely with what you said." And then you find out that they think you said exactly the opposite of what in fact you did say, because the people hear what they wish to hear, what is in their heads already. And of course, this is a very strange and disquieting fact. I mean, this communication isn't easy at all. And I mean, all the various psychological tests that have been made on memory, I mean, what the effect of remembering things. I mean, memory, in fact, sort of irons out all that is individual or original in the thing which has been read or heard, and you get something which is completely flat, and often, if the thing is very unorthodox, you get a memory of something which is exactly the opposite of what has been read or said. I mean, we have to face this fact that communication is a very difficult problem, that a lot of people don't wish to be communicated with except in terms of what they believe already. And how we avoid this?
Well, has this business of not being certain whether you are communicating had any effect on your style?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think one can only just go brutally ahead and hope for the best.
Well, with this feeling of not actually knowing ever whether you are effectively communicating, what is it really that keeps you at it, keeps the pen going across the paper?
Well, I happen to like it very much. I mean, I find the whole problem of arranging words in sentences and paragraphs extremely fascinating, and also I find it extremely instructive. I mean, it permits me to think out my ideas more clearly than I would otherwise.
Well, certainly one of the books of yours that is most discussed is Brave New World. If you were to write another Brave New World today, what differences or changes in emphasis do you think you would make?
Well, I would probably try to write an entirely different, I think Brave New World, there were obviously the defects, there were failures to foresee things, but of course there were also things which already have become true a great deal quicker than I thought they would. But I think a very interesting sort of sequel to Brave New World, which I would like someday to write, it's frightfully difficult, would be a description of some sort of a community in which a real effort was made to help individuals to develop their full potentialities. This would be a fascinating utopian experiment to go into. But of course it's always greatly easier to write about negative than about positive things, to criticize negative things and to set up positive. There are very few good positive figures in literature. Well, a good many critics have expressed sorrow that the early Huxley, the incisive and humorous satirist, has been replaced by the Huxley who is concerned with psychological and mystical things. Do you care to comment on this? Well, I don't think I've sacrificed the old one. I hope I still write very funny things from time to time. But I hope I've added another dimension. This is what I've been trying to do. I maybe failed. But I think in a certain sense the satirical side is the necessary complement of the other.
If we might return to the perennial philosophy, Mr. Huxley, I found a couple of statements in there very provocative. I'll read them. Only the pure in heart and poor in spirit can come to the unitive knowledge of God. Hence the attempt to impose more unity upon societies that their individual members are ready for makes it psychologically almost impossible for those individuals to realize their unity with the divine ground and with one another. Now, do you imply there that some contemporary societies are more nearly ready for this unity than are others?
Well, I would say that a society with political and civil liberty is more compatible with it. I mean, the psychological freedoms we were talking about just now, it seems to me, an individual question of individual choice. There are certain environments in which psychological freedom is a great deal more difficult than other environments. I would think that where you have a society like Nazi Germany or the worst type of communist oppression, I think you have the utmost difficulty in achieving psychological freedom because the rulers are extremely anxious that you should not achieve it and do everything in their power to prevent you and to put over a kind of education which makes it virtually impossible. So that, I do think that certain types of society are not only intrinsically better than others, but are better because they permit this other type of freedom. I do think that political and civil liberty permits what may be called psychological freedom in a way which other societies don't.
Is possible to have the psychological freedom and still be moving away from the unity with this divine ground or God. For instance, in America, I've heard many criticisms that although we are free psychologically and politically, that there's a tendency to move away, to put the emphasis on material things. Now, do you believe that we're moving further away, say, than the Oriental people?
I don't know. No, I don't think so. I would think that oddly enough, that the Oriental people at present, and a great many of them, are almost desperately preoccupied with material things. They're in a sort of state that the West was in 120 years ago, in its first sort of outburst of the Industrial Revolution, and that they have a passionate enthusiasm for these gadgets, which I think may be beginning to wear off a little here. I mean, people got used to them anyhow here. I mean, this is one of the troubles of the history, that it's moving at different rates in different parts of the world. I mean, that as the West begins to find extreme nationalism a little excessive and would like a tiny bit of cooperation, the East is now just intoxicated with nationalism and is rushing off at full speed, exactly as the West was in the time of Mazzini in 1840. So you have the difficulty that the two speeds, parts of the world moving at different speeds, and it's very difficult to jump from one to the other, to get one to understand the psychological condition of the other.
How do you personally view the Judeo-Christian society? How do you view the trend as pertains to this unity with God? Do you feel that we're getting closer, further away, or stagnant?
Well, I think that the whole, what I was speaking about earlier, that this sort of, whole sort of new thought train, which is obviously very important in all types of Western religion now, has stressed more and more this direct psychological experience of a cognitive kind. I mean, I think there is on the whole less stress in the West on the elaborate doctrinal dogmas now, and possibly less stress too on getting the type of religious experience which comes from very violent emotions, such as Wesley raised in talking about hellfire and so on, but more stress on the type of religious experience which may be called the unity view, knowledge of the divine ground, which is an inward mystical experience. I mean, I think this is a definite trend in modern Western religion.
Do you believe that an affliction contributes toward fulfilling the conditions of purity of heart and poorness in spirit, which you believe are necessary to apprehending this divine reality?
Well, here again, I mean, it can and it cannot. I mean, just as a by no means people who are physically poor need not necessarily be poor in heart, inasmuch as they probably have a passionate desire to be rich, and some few rich people, I think, can actually be poor in spirit. But I mean, here again, seems to me to depend on the individual case. I mean, I can imagine certain cases where it would be of assistance, and in other cases where the kind of overcompensation would take place and a kind of bumptiousness arise, which would be very detrimental. Again, these are they're so difficult to generalize, these psychological problems, because human beings are extraordinarily different from one another. But again, one can only answer by bringing out a large list of the people who have had physical handicaps and who have achieved something and see what in fact they did. I mean, at the, on the spur of the moment, I can't think of it would be an interesting subject to go into, actually, to write a little thesis on.
Mr. Huxley, Los Angeles is regarded by many of its critics as being the epitome of all the worst aspects of the chrome and neon civilization of the United States. It seems rather strange that a person like yourself, who has such a sharp eye for these tinsely things and an acid pen for them also, would come here to live.
Well, it has, in spite of everything, it has many merits, this extraordinary town. It's obviously got rather out of hand now. when you have a town 60 miles long and 40 miles wide, which is shortly going to be 100 miles long, 60 miles wide, then obviously something is happening which you just can't foresee. But until it gets 200 miles long and 100 miles wide, I think it's going to be all right. And of course, everything is here. I mean, the most fantastic and absurd things are here, but also a lot of extremely interesting things here. I mean, you can meet here very, very interesting people. They're all here, scattered about in this immense conglomeration.
Well, may I ask if you're working on any work of fiction now?
Well, I'm just, no, not at the moment. I'm just sort of vaguely thinking about something, but I don't know how far. It takes a long time for this to mature. It's no good to sometimes start things and then have to throw them all away. So it's no good starting too early.
Do you have any regular established work habits, or do you...
Yes, I work in the mornings always, and generally I go out in the early part of the afternoon and maybe work a little again before dinner.
Well, Mr. Huxley, we all certainly want to thank you for taking this time out to talk with us.
Well, I'm afraid it hasn't been very instructive what I have said about the afflictions, because as I say, I don't believe you can generalize. I think all of you will probably have now sit down and look up everybody who's had an affliction and find out what in fact they've done, how else the question can be answered. Because it's an interesting subject, actually. I wonder if somebody has written about it. It's quite possible they have. Some learned German is almost certainly.
Do you plan the decoration of this room?
Oh, my wife did it. We're very fond of this white vinylized floor. It's very wonderful material. And it isn't difficult to keep clean. It's washed once a week and brushed occasionally. You never have to wax it or polish it.
This is an unusually light room. That's why I asked.
Well, of course, everything is white. And of course, we have this extraordinary view. I mean, here, you can start off by Los Angeles, but this is why the right place.
Aldous Huxley slid open the glass doors which opened onto a patio and then invited us to step outside and enjoy his splendid view of Los Angeles. With obvious enthusiasm, Mr. Huxley detailed the virtues of his location. His house is perched almost atop a hill, and to the east are the wilds of Griffith Park. Spread out below is the Los Angeles Basin, the eye being able to sweep from the Civic Center in the east to Santa Monica and the Pacific in the west. Mr. Huxley regretted that we could not see the view at night, for then it was, in his words, incredibly beautiful. In admiring the view, one could not help wondering whether Mr. Huxley, for all his defective eyesight, might not be able to see it more clearly and admire it more deeply. As we were preparing to leave, Mr. Huxley mentioned that he had once worked as a journalist, but that he had found the burden of the deadline terribly oppressive and fatiguing. Commenting further on the journalistic profession, he said, "It's an awfully good field to get into if you make very sure that you get out of it." This interview has been another volume in the Library of Living Journalism, compiled by members of the Journalism Department of the University of California at Los Angeles. It was jointly produced by Marion Brennan, Carmen Hughes, Joe Morgan, and Wayne Johnson.